Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this is part six of the series Effective Living. Just before we start, first of all, a big mazel tov to Sarah, the new grandchild. Lots of nachas. And Bev, I'm not sure when it was born, but mazel tov to her as well. So today is the final week of this series called Effective Living. Just a reminder, it'll be on the email as well, but just a reminder, we're now going to take a break for a few weeks because I'm going overseas next week. We also had a grandchild last week, so I'm going to actually, we're going to visit the new grandchild, among other things. We'll do a short series towards the end of the term, which will be on 14th of June. So it's, we'll miss three Thursdays, and then I'll be back 14th of June, but obviously I'll send emails and reminders out and so on. But 14th of June, we're going to do one called the Pendulum Syndrome, looking for balanced living, which will be an interesting topic. I'll explain once we get there. So let me just begin by reviewing today. First of all, just a bit of review from last week. Last week we shared a almost like an isolated insight, an idea from based on a shiur, a lecture from Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, based on the philosopher, the Maharal of Prague, as I said last week, on the story of Rahav, that woman who was a promiscuous woman but then later converted and married Joshua, and out of her came great people. And I'm not going to go through the whole shiur again, of course, but just very briefly, we talked about the three parts of the human experience, which were the three things that she used, which was flax, the window, and the rope. Flax being the sense of loneliness, sometimes a longing, which people have, which are untapped, or it's a certain seeking and aspiration to look for something, to look for fulfillment, for creativity, but not knowing where to channel it. And therefore we start to explore, that's the window, and we explore things sometimes erroneously, and then we throw a rope and we make connections, but sometimes the connections are bad connections. And we talked about how to learn how to rechannel that and to understand that we have within us that deep sense of need for fulfillment, but we need to know how to explore the paradigm and what type of connections to make. But today what I want to do is I want to put it all together over the last, taking the series, and summarize some of the things we've been learning and just develop them a bit further to put them together. Just apologies, some people mentioned, there were a few people that mentioned that they wanted to get the link on the email and for some reason didn't come, so we're looking into that, why that happened, but we'll fix that hopefully. But anyway, today sort of is independent. So in the very beginning of the series, we mentioned Rabbi Twersky's quote from his book Effective Living, where he says a very simple sentence, but a very important sentence, and that is, change is hard, but change is possible. And we talked about the idea of achieving inner happiness, achieving motivation to lead to and accomplish and achieve real effective living is something which is difficult because it needs a lot of effort, but it's possible. Now, it's difficult because of a few things. First of all, we talked about the different forces within our personality, some of them being animalistic. And what happens is that the animalistic forces within our personality, as opposed to the human and moral forces within our personality, one of the things that we need to understand, that those animal drives within us that often lead to the wrong choices and lead to instant gratification and mistaken fulfillment, those forces are stronger and quicker, right? And therefore often take over without us even getting a chance to be ahead and make the right choices. As we said 2 weeks ago, we talked about the idea of motivation, that Rabbi Twersky said there's no such thing as lack of motivation. There's always motivation. It's just a question if it's negative motivation or positive motivation. So the example we gave was that when you can't get out of the bed in the morning and you sleep in a few hours because you're not motivated to get up and do what you need to do, it's not you're not motivated. You are motivated. You're motivated to stay in bed and rest. Or be lazy, or whatever the case is, right? But negative motivation is normally based on a quick fix or instant gratification. It's finding what we think will be fulfilling or what we think will fill our needs quickly. And obviously, long term, that doesn't work. Right? Now, this concept, by the way, and that's why it's difficult sometimes to seek a life of effective living, not to do the things that we talked about in Chloe Madonis' article, that tongue-in-cheek article, where we sometimes want to be happy but yet engage in activities that, or mindsets or emotional responses that don't bring us happiness, because our subconscious mind sends us a message that it'll give us short-term happiness, short-term pleasure, short-term fulfillment, and we want something quickly. And therefore, because we want something quickly, we choose that path, and that drive happens a lot quicker. That, by the way, that concept is much, much more relevant today, because today, in today's society, really, there's an obsession with instant results, much, much more than many years ago. I was just talking to someone last night where I was reminiscing about the time that I went to yeshiva when I left home in South Africa and traveled overseas to study in yeshiva, and to make contact with home, there was two things. Once in a while, I used to make a reverse charges call from a payphone. Remember payphones? or I used to write aerograms. Remember those blue aerograms? And of course, I was always the guilty one. I was always the one that was told that I don't write often enough. My older brother, of blessed memory, when he went to yeshiva, every week he would send a. He was a good boy. He would send a week every a letter every week. Now, I was just saying that in context because a few days ago my new grandson had a bris, and modern technology has its benefits. So I was able to FaceTime the bris, and it was beautiful. I was part of it even though I missed it. So that's fantastic. But the problem, the flip side is that we want instant results. We need to instantaneously connect. We instant communication. We send an email and want an instant response. And we actually don't have more time. We don't have time to think anymore. There's no space. And part of what we have talked about, that we'll talk about today, is the need to have to grab the conscious mind, the need for the conscious mind to be in charge, which means to have time to process, to have time to think, to have time to make decisions, to have time to weigh up options, pros and cons, right and wrong, and so on and so forth. So we all basically want everything, and we want it now. So that becomes a problem, and therefore that leads often to a lack of happiness, because we choose pathways which are very strong in terms of our drives, in terms of what we want, and it seems the better option, at least short term, and that's why we choose them, and that's a problem. The other part of the problem is this, that people often complain. I want to just explain this a bit, because it does take effort to rechannel this. Sometimes people are set back because they have setbacks. What I mean by that is that sometimes people try to engage in healthy living, healthy emotional responses, healthy choices, and so on and so forth. And then they're all inspired to do that, and then they have setbacks. And often people say, it just doesn't work. It's not going to work for me. I've tried, it doesn't work. Right? So I want to just stop a second and share with you a model so we understand how this works in terms of the human personality. And I'm going to use a model connected to the time of the year that we're in the Jewish calendar, because we're coming out towards the end of the Omer period, where we had the 7 weeks, and in a couple of days we're going to have the festival of Shavuot, which of course is the festival which we commemorate the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And that's an important festival, because it's really where it all began in terms of our identity as a nation. But we are taught, the commentaries teach us, that the journey from Egypt to Mount Sinai was a 7-week journey that actually is divided into three parts. On the first day of Pesach, which we celebrate the Exodus from Egypt, we have a Seder and so on, we celebrate God schlepping us out of slavery. He took us out. And the purpose of going out of Egypt, explicitly communicated by God to Moses at the burning bush, was to get to Mount Sinai. And yet God insisted that we take 7 weeks to get there. It didn't have to take 7 weeks, but he wanted us to go on a journey. And in that journey, he asked us to count the days, to count the 49 days, and to have a period of self-refinement and self-growth, and only then arrive at Mount Sinai, which was the third part, and actually receive the divine revelation of Mount Sinai and get the Torah. What's the idea? So I want to share with you an insight based on an interesting verse that King Solomon writes in the book called Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. Sorry, I got the Hebrew on the one side, the English on the side. So there's a verse, I don't know if you know this, but King Solomon wrote a book called Song of Songs. It's a very cryptic part of Tanakh. It's a love story, actually, almost, but it's a love story of God and the Jewish people. and it's written all in riddles, and the commentaries sort of decode exactly what it means. And one of those verses, it says that the Jewish people turn to God and say, Moshcheini, draw me, right? Draw me, and then like pull me. And then we commit and we say, if you do that, Acharecha Narutza, we will run after you. So you draw me, and then we will run after you. And then it says, Hevi'ani Hamelach Chadarav Nagilav Nisrabach, which means the king has brought me into his chambers and we will rejoice with you. Now, what does that mean? So the commentaries explain that Moshcheini, draw me, is what God did when we went out of Egypt. In other words, he took us out of Egypt. He said, come, come with me. Now, the Jewish people in Egypt, I don't know if you know this, were spiritually very immature. They were sunken in the depths of assimilation. They had lost really a lot of their Jewish connection. I mean, they were still the Jewish people and had the basic faith, but they had lost a lot of it, and they needed to be taken out. So God said, so God pulls us out. He takes us out. And then we say, we will run after you. That refers to the time of the Omer, and then the king has brought me into his chambers, refers to the Mount Sinai revelation. But the point I want to bring across is this. The commentaries ask, what does it mean? Why is it this verse, the first two parts of the verse are very inconsistent? It's draw me in the singular. And then it says, we will run after you, which is an inconsistent sentence structure, right? If it's talking about, if an individual is talking, it should say, draw me and I will run after you, correct? If it's the Jewish people collectively talking, it should be, draw us and we will run after you. So it's inconsistent. So the mystics explain the verse in the following way. And this goes to the heart of a very common human problem. Many people complain that sometimes they go through a period of tremendous inspiration. They're all fired up. They're going to change. They're going to transform. They're going to improve their relationships. They're going to get angry less. They're going to eat better. They make New Year resolutions, whatever the case is. And it dissipates afterwards. They lose the inspiration. And the question is why? And there's many reasons. But here's one of them. What happens is as follows. As we've spoken about many times, including this series. The human being is a complex machine. And part of the complexity is that we have two very distinct parts of who we are. One is an animal drive, which is there for a reason, as we'll talk soon. And the other one is more of a godly moral drive. Right? And they struggle. Picture it as it's two people struggling, wrestling with each other. For the upper hand, for dominance. When we are given inspiration, in other words, and the emphasis on given, when we are given inspiration to kickstart a process, when I say given, I mean we don't work for it ourselves. When we're given it, when we experience an amazing idea, when we hear a fantastic lecture, when we read an amazing book, or we come to an amazing time of the year, whatever the case is, or it's Yom Kippur at the end of the service, whatever, right? And we suddenly we feel all fired up. We're actually a bit mistaken some of the time. What has actually happened is that only part of us is fired up. And the other part is anesthetized. What do I mean? When God gives us inspiration, the part of us that responds to that inspiration is the godly part of us. The animal is animal. You talk to a cow from today till tomorrow about being inspired, it's not going to help. Well, it's different by person, as we'll soon see. But, right? In other words, what happens is a person can live a very animalistic life, a very superficial life, and what's happening during that experience is that their animal soul is dominant, their godly soul is in the background, is asleep, is weak. And sometimes when a person is given an injection of inspiration, the godly soul wakes up. So picture it, if you can see the imagery of two people fighting. One person's on top, one person's at the bottom, and suddenly the person on the bottom gets a sudden surge of strength, adrenaline, and just wins. Fights back, gets on top, right? But the other person is still the enemy. So sometimes we feel like we're totally inspired, and now we're ready, we've changed our mindset, we've turned the leaf, we're just going to change. And in fact, what is really happening is the godly part of us is very energized, and the animal hasn't changed. The animal has just been weakened and is like almost anesthetized. And then a couple days later, the animal wakes up and says, hold on a second. I'm back. The animal fights back. Because the animal never changed. The animal's still the animal. It's just weakened. So that's why when it comes to Pesach, we say to God, draw me. Start the process. And I understand that when you start the process, God, when you take me out of Egypt, and I haven't done anything about it just yet, you're only drawing one part of me. That's why it's in the singular. Draw me, the godly soul. However, my commitment is, now that I'm inspired, I'm going to be smart about it. What I'm going to do is, I'm going to start working on my entire character. And I'm going to start refining myself. And I'm going to start elevating myself. I'm going to start the hard work of real reform, of getting every part of me on side. And that's why the second part is, Acharecha Narutza, we will run after you. I promise I will bring every part of me. Because if I don't do the hard work, if I don't start really investing the effort to actually really refine the animal part of me and getting it on side, after a few days, it's going to fight back. Which just interestingly, by the way, that's why the Omer is 7 weeks. 7 weeks referring to the seven emotions. Because as we've talked about, the animal part of us lives in the world of emotion. Right? The emotions are predominantly animalistic, impulsive, instinctive. Whereas the conscious mind is more the seat of the godly moral perspective that we have. Right? That's why also, interestingly enough, the Omer, not today, but in the original Omer, the counting of the Omer, the 7 weeks, started on the second day of Pesach, where in temple times they would bring a special sacrifice, a flower offering. Now, interestingly enough, the Torah has a different types of sacrifices, and there's many types of flower offerings, which are made out of ground wheat or grain and was flour. But almost always, the flower offerings that were brought in the temple were wheat. But the Omer was barley. Now, today it's a bit different because today everyone eats all different kinds of things. But in ancient times, wheat was considered human food and barley was considered animal fodder. Right? Today, because we've become health conscious, so we... I had a great uncle. I used to go to him for Shabbos in New York when I was studying in Yeshiva. And he was a very old-fashioned, old-school type of guy. Very well off, got a beautiful Shabbos table and like that. But in his house, there were no salads on Shabbos. Only fish, meat, real traditional Shabbos foods, not salads. So I once asked his grandson, what's with your grandfather? What's the story with no... What's his policy of no salads? He says... His grandfather says that only animals essen gros, which means only animals eat grass. But you know, today we're more sort of aware of healthy stuff, so we eat. Anyway, so the symbolism at least of wheat and barley is, that wheat is human food and barley is animal food, which is why the Torah says on the second day Pesach, bring a flour offering out of barley and then start the 7 weeks, because the whole process of the Omer is working on the animal side of who we are. Which is why we begin with that flower offering, the Bali one, right? Now, that process of really creating real change within our real personality, meaning not just that godly spark within us or the moral consciousness that's within us, but the animal part that's in us, that takes time. That's hard work. That's a process which has setbacks. And that's a process where sometimes we succeed, sometimes we fail. As the inspiration tends to wear off, it's a little harder. We have to know to do it step by step. We have to do it with hard work. We have to often have a lot of self-control. We have to really think hard. We have to invest effort. We have to do the things that we spoke about 2 weeks ago, which we're going to speak about again today, some more ideas, some more concepts. That's very, very hard. So the question is, why did God do that? Why did He make it so hard? And why does He give us an animal like that? Why are we all born with a drive that is very animalistic? I'm asking the question because I want to share with you an idea that's brought down by the Hasidic masters based on mystical teachings. That there's a concept called the powerful ox. It's based on a verse that says, Rav tu'ot b'kashar. What does that mean? You see, a couple of weeks ago, I shared with you this idea that we have within us two worlds, the world of what we call tikkun and the world of tohu, the world of order and the world of chaos. Right? This is the way it works. The animal force within us is a world of chaos. The godly force within us is a world of order. What does that mean? So, by default, as we're born, the way it works is that the animal force is driven by impulse, it's normally egocentric. It's chaotic, it's reactionary, it's impulsive, it doesn't think, it just acts, it goes all over the place. Normally what happens is in the world of chaos, there's no congruence, there's no consistency. It's not like the mind and the heart and behavior is all consistent. It's just all over the place. And normally that means we have lack of self-control and lack of mastery. Whereas the world of order, which is the world within us that contains the godly force, number one, is driven not by emotional responses, but driven by intellectual decision-making. It's normally selfless and can have the foresight and insight to submit to something higher. It's orderly, it's calm, it's proactive, it brings synchrony and congruence, and that's where we achieve mastery. Now, one of the ways to understand this is the truth is that it's not just an animal and a godly person, but the truth is that we're all born, and in fact, the dominant force initially within our lives is the animal force. How do I know that? Take a child. Right? A child is a chaotic world. Right? Little children are not, first of all, they're egocentric in a very beautiful and pure way. The world completely revolves around them, which is okay. It's just not okay when you're an adult, when you don't grow out of it, but it's okay as a child. It's very passionate, completely unpredictable and inconsistent. Children can become incredibly angry and be very happy the next minute. I've always said this as a parenting thing. Often when we have, you know, parents ask me about sibling rivalry, I'll say sibling rivalry, for kids at least, is a much bigger problem for the parents than it is for the child. Because, you know, have you ever seen two kids fight, almost kill each other, and then 5 seconds later they're playing with each other? The parents are still having a heart attack and don't know what to do and full of anxiety, but the children are fine, right? They make irrational decisions. They're impulsive. They sometimes do things that we cannot understand why they're doing it. They do the most craziest things. The world of a child is the world of chaos. But here's the thing. The pasuk, the verse tells us the power of an ox. What does that mean? Rav tvuot bekoach shor. There's tremendous energy. There's tremendous potential in the power of an animal. See, that chaos, and this is such an important thing, and it goes to what we were talking about last week. That chaos that we have within us, that impulsivity, that instinctiveness, that reactiveness that we have in the animal part of our existence, which children have almost in their whole existence because they don't have the intellectual maturity which carries with it the moral voice, the godly voice, right? That chaos contains tremendous potential. It contains amazing creativity, amazing infinity, amazing spontaneity. That's only in the world of chaos. The world of order and the world of maturity is beautiful, but it's limited, it's structured, and therefore it's got its limitation. The world, the animal world that we have within us, the chaotic world, contains amazing creativity, amazing passion, amazing excitement. And that's why often in the human experience, one of the greatest tragedies almost is for when parents do this to children or children do this to themselves as we grow older and as we hopefully adopt the more mature side and we learn to give the mature side, the moral side, the conscious side, mastery. We learn to give the head mastery over the heart and we learn to guide our emotions and we learn to channel our animalistic forces. The tragedy sometimes is that we don't guide the animal forces, we suppress it. In modern times, they always talk about the child within you. That's such an important thing. It's an old Jewish concept. We shouldn't lose the child within us. We shouldn't lose that creativity. We shouldn't lose that spontaneity. We shouldn't lose that risk-taking approach that the irrational mind has, right? We have to learn to guide it. We have to learn to steer it in the right way. But there's a passion, there's an excitement, there's potential which is in the animal part of us that cannot be found in the rational part of us. And that's why God gave it to us. And He said, I'm giving you this amazing present. In its raw form, it's completely chaotic. It's completely crazy. But it's got the most amazing potential. As we've said before, you know, in the Shema we say every day, it says, Ve'ahavtat Hashem Elokecha, you should love God, your God, b'chol levavcha, with all your heart. But in Hebrew, the word levavcha, it should say, grammatically, it should say libcha, your heart, with the one time, the letter bet. And the Shema has twice the letter bet, levavcha. Why? Because the Talmud says, because God says, I want you to love me with both parts of you, both your hearts, both your inclinations, both your drives. because each one has a contribution to make. So therefore, the human experience is that the spiritual side of us, the godly force of us, God is prepared to draw, he's prepared to energize. He'll give us inspiration. He'll give it to us. Once in a while, we'll re-energize it. But the hard work to bring the animal inside, that takes a lot of work, a lot of challenges, a lot of setbacks. But at the end, if we can do it without suppressing and killing the animal, but rather channeling and guiding the animal, it makes a much richer, a much more emotionally healthy, a much more infinite and greater and passionate life. And that's why we have it with all its difficulty. It's one of the reasons that God gave it to us and structured us like that. In fact, he designed us that when we're born, that's the part of us that comes first. That's the part of us that has to develop first. A child has to be a child. A child has to be someone who's crazy. Because that's how you develop. That's how you develop the child. The personality of the child has to come out. It's a pity on the educators, but right, children are hard to manage sometimes because, and by the way, as we said last week, the more difficult the child, the more potential the child has. It might damage the parent in the meantime, but by the way, sorry, that's a real grandparent line because you don't have to deal with it anymore. Yeah, sorry, you're dancing. Okay, so that's a really separate long discussion, but just very briefly, it's got to do with what we talked about last week. In other words, sometimes if you see, let's say, in a child, or for that matter in ourselves, we see a character trait that's expressing itself in a negative way. Instead of just saying, sometimes temporarily we have to say stop, because I mean what they're doing might be just inappropriate or bad or dangerous even. But we also have to sometimes think about why are they doing that? What's behind it? Oh, access our child. Well, the same thing. Sometimes we need to understand what's driving us to do certain things. What is even driving us to do things that we know aren't working for us. And sometimes go deeper and try find a part of us that can be channeled. But it's a good question. Maybe we'll come back to it sometime because it needs to be okay. So that's why it takes a lot of work. So it does take a lot of work. But when we're able to master that, number one, the inspiration is maintained and sustained because it's become part of us. It doesn't dissipate, step by step at least. I mean, we need to keep energizing, we have to keep reviewing, we have to keep coming and inspiring ourselves, but we still have to also do the work. That's the Omer, the 7 weeks. We've got to work on our character, refine ourselves, try and improve as a human being, even when it's hard. And it does take a lot of work, it does take a lot of investment, but that's part of what makes us a deep human being. Now, in summary, what is it all about at the end of the day? It's all about one thing, really. Or one thing first, I should say. And that is getting back the conscious mind. Right? That idea we spoke about over the few weeks. In other words, rather than allowing our subconscious, irrational part of our layer of a personality to connect with our irrational emotions and send us egocentric, irrational, illogical messages that make us do things which are not going to bring us inner fulfillment and purpose and happiness. It's about claiming back the conscious mind and allowing us, therefore, to create space within our mind to have a vision, to have moral clarity, to be able to make decisions, to think things through. And again, as I've said so many times, this is more difficult nowadays. It goes back to the whole mindfulness discussion because it is more difficult nowadays because people react quickly nowadays. No one wants to actually stop and think through things. As I mentioned, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, that one of the things we need to do, for example, is work out what, in terms of creating motivation, is work out what our values are. How many people can actually say that they dedicate time and sit and spend time working out what their values are, thinking about their values, thinking about their mission and purpose in life? Right, we don't give enough time, we don't give enough focus to the conscious mind nowadays. We think we're working through the conscious mind, but often what we're doing is the conscious mind is just becoming a puppet of the subconscious or the irrational part of our mind, and that's the problem. We need to give our conscious mind a lot more space and give it mastery. There's a very beautiful article which I read from Rabbi Sacks. It's titled Reframing, because he talks about the whole power of the conscious mind. And what the conscious mind does is it gives us, it doesn't change the situation, but it gives us space and clarity to reinterpret a situation and to see beyond the superficial and to be able to see deeper, not just on the surface, so we can make proper decisions, right? And in this article, it's a very beautiful article. If you want to Google it, it's called Rabbi Sacks Reframing. And he talks about, well, he talks first of all about the interesting phenomenon that when the science of psychology began not so long ago, it just happens to be that many, probably most of the leading psychologists were Jewish, which is an interesting thing. He says apparently in Europe, it was known as the Jewish science, right? Not always so positively, actually. But he says some of the, so he focuses on three great leading, more modern psychologists, post-Freud psychologists, right? Or therapists. He focuses on Viktor Frankl and Aaron Beck and Martin Seligman, who each in their own way developed a very, very fascinating theory of psychology and therapy and so on and so forth. So Viktor Frankl, you know, was logotherapy, the man's search for meaning, right? Beck was responsible a lot for the idea of cognitive therapy, and Martin Seligman, of course, more recently is amazing in his work that he did in positive psychology. But he says something very interesting. He says that these are all very different approaches, but they have one thing in common. They are based on the belief, which was set out much earlier in mystical philosophy, and he quotes particularly the Tanya of Shlomo Zalman of Ladi, that he says the philosophy is that if we change the way we think, we can change the way we feel. It's the idea we've talked about many times of the head ruling the heart and not the other way around. Right? It's if we change the way we think, we change the way we feel. Right? Oh, here we are. Which is very, very foundational. Now, it doesn't always happen automatically, but that's the starting point. And that's why I said before that the starting point is getting back control of the conscious mind. And that was like Viktor Frankl, for example. I mean, if you read his book, it's absolutely fascinating. That's exactly what he did. He didn't change the situation. He said he couldn't change the situation. He was imprisoned. He was in a camp. What he could do is he could look at it differently. He could imagine things differently, which he attributed tremendously to his own survival. Right? He could come to the conclusion that in his own mindset, no one could ever steal his freedom away from him, which was an amazing thing. I mean, it's the most amazing work, right? And he set out in the camps to help other people, to prevent other people from taking their own lives by giving them a sense of purpose, by giving them a way to interpret their surroundings in the most negative and adverse of surroundings that could possibly be imagined, right? And in cognitive therapy, says this idea became known as reframing. Reframing means where you don't change a situation, but you learn to re-understand it. And one of the great examples in the biblical stories of reframing in this way was the story of Joseph. Right? Joseph and his brothers. And we've mentioned this before, but just in context of this discussion, it's good to mention it again. Joseph had every reason to do all the things that Chloe Medanis talks about in her article, not to be happy, to blame others, to focus on the past, to turn himself into a complete victim, to sit and ruminate and think about how negative things are, not to have gratitude. Why? Because as we mentioned last week, Joseph was a person, in a different context, but Joseph was a person who at 17 years old, you have to think about what this means, 17 years old, he was sold into slavery by his 10 older brothers. Right? Sold into slavery from one person to the next. He was challenged by Potiphar's wife, as we talked about last week. He was thrown into jail. He was forgotten in jail. Like he was there for 10 years, and then the butler and the bakers finally were released, and he asked the butler a favor to mention him to Pharaoh to maybe try and get him out, and the butler forgot. Forgot. It wasn't in his mind. Joseph wasn't a priority. And therefore he spent another 2 years in jail, comes out, and within minutes transforms into the viceroy of Egypt, and eventually his brothers come down. And through the whole very, very beautiful and dramatic story that takes place in the Chumash of how it all unfolds, which is one of the most, remember as a child, one of the most exciting stories in the Chumash, right? Eventually we come to the moment where he cannot contain himself anymore, and the brothers, of course, didn't recognize him, he recognized them, but there came that final moment when he turns to them and he says, Ani Yosef, I am Joseph. And there was total shock. And the brothers are petrified, justifiably so. This is the ruler of Egypt. This is the prime minister of Egypt. We were terrible to him. And they recognized that, and they acknowledged their responsibility. And they were petrified that he was going to turn around and just take revenge like never before. And he could have. He was in the power to do that. And he sensed that right away, and he turns to them and he says, "And now do not be distressed," he tells them, "or angry with yourselves because you think that you sold me down to Egypt, because you didn't sell me down to Egypt. God sent me here to preserve life." God, because the whole story was that he was in charge of then, in times of famine, he gave the advice to Pharaoh to store food and so on and so forth. He says, "I have a purpose. I have a purpose why I'm here. I'm not focusing on the past. There's a purpose, there's meaning, I have a life of fulfillment. I'm going to have a life of fulfillment. I'm going to interpret my experience now as one of meaning and purpose. I'm going to look deeper. I'm going to understand the divine plan which is behind this, which is sometimes very difficult to understand. I'm going to let go of feelings of resentment and revenge. I'm going to not blame. I'm going to not focus on the past. So you have nothing to worry about." Later on, when his father dies, Yaakov, who came down to Egypt, the brothers again thought, well, maybe he was just nice to us, you know, as long as Jacob was alive, but now we're in trouble again. And they go to him and they say, it would be good memory for your father not to start up with us. And he cries and he says, right? And he says, "You don't need to worry about it. I don't have any feelings of revenge. I mean, it's a very, very high level." Right? But, you know, we always tell stories in the ideal form so we can understand the model. But he was a person who was completely focused on interpreting his experience to give meaning and purpose. How did he do that? It wasn't an instinctive response, because the instinctive response, the impulsive response or instinctive response, reactive response of every single normal human being would be one of revenge. Like, how could you?
Did he become not revengeful because of what happened to him and that he learned, or because he was born
that way? That's a good question. So, as we said last week, well, obviously he was on a higher level than all of us. I understand that, but. And no one ever recommends, and that's always a problem with these stories. Like, we're not suggesting. Look, I think the answer to that, I mean, it's a good question. I think the answer to that is like this. There are certain people that have a bigger tendency to positivity than others, no question. And the question is, where's the fairness in that? Like, why did God make some people more positive than others? And I think the answer is this. Because we also know of many, many, many stories of people who went through tremendous adversity, even within themselves, rough character, and finally learned not to do that. And they weren't born that way, and they learned to become that way. And part of why they learned to become that way is because they had role models, and the role models are those few people that God creates, so they should show us a lesson. So in terms of Joseph, I don't know the answer, but it's not that relevant, because the values or the morals or the teachings that we learn is that it's something we can all aspire to on each of us in our own level, and the story of Joseph is there to guide us, whether it was hard for him or not. I imagine it was hard for him because he also went through his struggles. He went through the struggles we talked about last week. There's a midrash that says that even Moses went through these inner struggles. King David went through inner struggles. Lots of people went through inner struggles. But okay, they might have been on a greater level, perhaps, but they create a model for us to learn from, because part of the fundamental belief, and particularly Jewish belief, is that if we give the rational mind enough space and we allow the rational mind to be open, as we'll soon explain, to the essence of who we are, to be open to higher values and higher morals and a greater power, we can change the way we feel. If we change the way we think, we can change the way we feel. That's the basis of positive psychology. That's the modern version. But the truth is that it's very, very strongly rooted in the teachings of Jewish teachings. One of the greatest models is Joseph. Now, it's true. In Joseph, it's at a bizarre ideal level. I don't know if anyone of us could ever reach that, not to feel any trace of resentment. That's hard in this circumstance. But we can certainly take steps towards it. I think that's, as we've said many, many times, that's the mission of the human being. It's not to reach perfection, but it's to take steps towards that model. That's the idea. Now, when we talk about giving space to the conscious mind, what that means is, see, the conscious mind allows us to think, and allows us to think with different perspectives and deeper and further, and therefore to be able to make decisions. But also the conscious mind gives us space, or the conscious mind is the window through which our real identity can come through. And that's an important point to understand. Because after all said and done, who we really are is to, right, is to make the right decision. It's just who we really are when we're born is hidden. In other words, who we really are is not to hate, is not to be resentful, is not to take revenge, is not to be materialistic, is not to be superficial. That's the animal force within us that allows us to come to the surface, and it's very powerful, and therefore it seems to be who we are a lot of the time. And therefore we need the Omer, we need the refinement, we need the personal growth journey to be able to work on that. But we do that by giving control back to the conscious mind. But what the conscious mind does is, it doesn't just think and make decisions. The conscious mind also is an opening. It's a vehicle, it's a vessel through which the real identity of the person can be expressed. The real identity of who we are can manifest itself. And where does it manifest itself? In other words, where does the essence of the human being manifest itself? In the conscious mind. The conscious mind is the opening, or the window through which the essence of who we are can actually be expressed. And therefore, it's through that process, through the conscious mind, and through the conscious mind being open to a deeper sense of paradigm, a deeper sense of morality, that we can change our perspective. We can change our whole outlook. We can change from the short-term self-preservation of the animal drive to the long-term life of focus and meaning and purpose. So you talk about people with challenges. I just saw, I don't know if you're aware, but in Sydney at the moment, there's the most fascinating person. Unfortunately, I was just so busy this week, I didn't get to hear him, but there's his name is Richard Bernstein. Richard Bernstein was born blind and is in Michigan, and he was just not so long ago appointed as one of the supreme, he's a judge. He became a lawyer, then became a judge, and he was appointed to the Supreme Court, one of the judges of the Supreme Court in the state of Michigan. A Jewish guy is right now here. I think one of the organizations brought him out, but he's been on radio, on television, and he's an amazing, amazing, amazing person. I just heard a clip of him this morning, and one line caught my attention because I knew we'd be discussing this, and it just was the right exact what we're talking about. Because one of the commentators asked him the following. He wasn't just born blind, which obviously meant he had tremendous, he was, like he says, yes, what takes you 1 hour will take me 5 hours. He's got to memorize. I mean, he memorizes like 20 court cases a week. And he memorizes everything, and he's got to be able to make decisions, and he's able to challenge his colleagues and argue and debate. It's the most amazing person. He's also run marathons and triathlons and all kinds of amazing, amazing things. An amazing person, without a question, right? When he finished college and he became a lawyer, I don't exactly remember the number, but it was something like 40 interviews he had. And he was turned down from every single firm. No one wanted to hire a blind lawyer, right? So he started backwards, right? So the person on the television asks him the question, he says, how do you do this, right? So he says the following sentence, he says, because for me, he says, life is not all smiles, that's true, but for me it's about purpose. That's the most amazing sentence. He says, for me it's about purpose. And that's exactly what we're talking about. You see, the difference between making, like, you know, that article I shared with you a few weeks ago, that you know, the idea of choosing to be miserable and choosing to focus on the negative and so on and so forth, it boils down to one thing. Do we choose what makes us feel good short-term right now, instant gratification, and easier? So it's easier just to blame others. It's easier just to let fear take over. It's easier to shift responsibility. It's easier to be negative by default. Or do we look for purpose? Look for purpose is a long-term decision. Look for purpose is not in 5 seconds. Look for purpose means thinking. It means focusing on your values. It means being driven. It means overcoming obstacles. It means looking beyond the now. In the now, but beyond the now. Yeah. Right. Someone else's problem.
And you're shifting from
right.
If you were sent, then you're there for a purpose.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, well put, well put. I must mention, however, that I think we've talked about this before, that Joseph's perspective on himself, that he was sent rather than sold, was for him. That doesn't mean that the people who sold him don't have to take responsibility. That's a separate discussion altogether. and that's a theological discussion which is very complicated. But we have talked about it before, because like the worst thing we can do is we do something bad to someone to say to them, well, get over it because it's obviously meant to happen. That's their problem, not ours, right? Right? Our problem is to make the moral positive. We have to make the morally positive choices for ourselves, and to hurt someone else is immoral. And we have to bear responsibility for that, and we have to fix that and ask for forgiveness and do tshuva and so on and so forth. But that's separate from how the person has to view themselves. That's what Job was able to do. And like you say, Richard Bernstein, the same sort of thing. So a couple of things we need to do, and I'm just going to end with this, because this is what Rabbi Twersky sort of in his book goes through these things, is therefore if we do look for purpose, there's a couple of things that happen. And a couple of things that we use the conscious mind to be able to work through. And that is, number one, the concept of embracing failure. Right? It's exactly the same thing. You see, if you're looking for short-term gain and we're looking for someone to blame and shift the responsibility, so failure is a problem, and many, many people are scared of failure. And often we don't do things, we don't engage in positive behavior and positive decisions because we're scared of failing. But if we look at life as a whole and look at life as a journey of purpose, failure is a good thing. Because we only learn from our mistakes. We only become better people from mistakes. We only become better people from learning from the things that we perhaps should have done differently. The other thing we learn to do is not harp on the past. And that's such an important one. This is a little bit of a Yiddish, I don't know if everyone will get this, but Rabbi Twersky tells a little story. He says that his mother, every Friday night, is one of the Shabbos traditional foods in some communities. I don't even know how you say it in English. It's something called farfel. What's farfel in English? I don't even know. So he says that every Friday night when his mother would serve the farfel, it's a beautiful idea, I never saw this before. He says every Friday night when his mother would serve the farfel, she would put the farfel on the table and she would say, okay, it's Shabbos today, whatever happened during the week is farfalon. Which means it happened already, finished, gone, done. Which in Yiddish is farfal, a play on the words in farfal. It was very nice, right? Now, what does that mean? Of course, it doesn't mean that the past is gone, right? And this is sometimes one of the misunderstood things about the mindfulness teachings, which I think maybe is where Jewish mindfulness differs a bit from modern mindfulness, which is, in Jewish thought, we actually do bring in the past in a tremendous way. That's the whole idea of tshuva. That's the whole idea of responsibility. But what it does mean is, we learn from the past. We take the past with us, right? That's why, for example, in going back to the counting of the Omer, when we count the Omer, we don't count down. We don't say 49, 48, 47. We count up. Because each day we count, we have with us. Each day we're supposed to take with us. When we're older, we hopefully have a lifelong or years of experience that we can learn from, the good and the bad, right? So we take the past with us. Of course we embrace the past. We learn from the past. The past becomes our teacher. But we don't let it weigh us down. The things of the past that we cannot control, we let go. We let go of the effect of the past. We let go of the baggage of the past. And we focus on the freshness of the now. Right? Because when we harp on the past, what we're doing essentially is we're not taking responsibility. It's short-term gain. We're just trying to blame the past. We blame our parents. We blame our upbringing. We blame the third grade teacher. We blame who knows what. Because it's all which could have all been true. But it doesn't help us. In other words, it's not going to get us any sense of purpose. Richard Bernstein had plenty to blame. He could have blamed the 42 firms that turned him down for a lifetime of misery. But then he would have been miserable. He wouldn't have had a lifetime of purpose. He chose not to. He chose what they did. Their short-sightedness was their short-sightedness. But he chose to look for a life of purpose and to overcome struggle. And he landed up an amazing person. Right? Which goes into the other thing, of course, that we learn not to blame. Because when we learn not to blame, there might be people who we could blame for lots of things that happen in life. But it doesn't help us. If you're looking for a life of purpose, purpose comes from within. Purpose comes from our reframing. Purpose comes from the way we look at things. Purpose comes from the way we, in our mind, decide to interpret our situation and to make it work. It doesn't help us that someone else did something that they shouldn't have done. Which, of course, then means we let go of resentment. We don't hate. Because it doesn't help to hate. We look at Yosef, that Yosef didn't hate, he let go of hate, because he would have held on to the hate, again, he wouldn't be able to achieve the purpose. We don't hold on to guilt, and we've talked about this before. Guilt is... Guilt is something which could be beneficial, but not when it takes control, not when it paralyzes us. So these are the things that we learn to do once we have the conscious mind controlling us. Once we give ourselves time to stop and think, which goes back to the mindfulness. We all need to do this. We need to dedicate time to focus, to think about our life, to reflect, to learn from the day, to think about our past experiences, what we can learn from them, to think about our morals and our values going forward. And I just want to quickly end off with three things, because we're coming up this Sunday, as I said, to the Festival of Shavuot. So just in this regard, just to learn three quick lessons from the concept of Shavuot. And that is, one of the ways to use our conscious mind to change our paradigm is to give ourselves up, to surrender to something which is hard, something which is beyond us. So the concept we know of Shavuot is that the Jews, when they were offered the Torah, they said, Na'aseh v'nishma, the famous words. They said, we'll do, we'll submit, we'll surrender, because it takes a bit of surrendering. Because sometimes our default position, our egocentric position is, it's this one's fault, it's that one's fault, how could this person do this to me, how could this happen to me, and so on and so forth. And to break out of that is hard. It is hard, because the pain can sometimes be very, very big. But nevertheless, when we have the approach of, let me use my conscious mind to entertain something which is higher than myself, a deeper purpose, a higher ideal, then we were able to embrace that whole experience. The second thing is about letting go. You know that on Shavuot there's a custom, because every Jewish festival must be connected with food. So therefore there's a custom to eat milk foods, right? Milk products. One of the many, many reasons are given for this. One of the ideas is that a milk product is baby food. And baby food is the concept that they talk about in mindfulness of the freshness of the moment. That we need to know that what happened in the past, fafalan, as we said, it's gone. But we can learn from the past, but every moment, doesn't matter where we've come from, we can always use our conscious mind to focus on the now, to make decisions for the now, to reframe the now, and to move on and to make our life a better life and a more meaningful and purposeful life. And then, of course, to take this custom of milk even further, the real Jewish custom is not just to have milk on Shavuot, but to have cheese, hence the cheesecakes, right? And what's the idea of the cheesecakes? And I once saw a beautiful idea. Why, if we have to have milk on Shavuot, why isn't just milk good enough? Why do we have to have cheese? So they say the difference between milk and cheese is this, and this goes back to what we spoke about at the beginning today. Milk is natural. Milk is what comes out of the cow. Milk is what's given to us. Cheese is what we make of it. So milk is, right? Milk is that first day of Pesach. It's the initial inspiration. It's the energizing of our godly soul. But then we've got to change. We've got to work hard. We've got to put in the effort, and we can. And that's why when God took us out of Egypt and He brought us to Shavuot, that whole process, we eat cheese to show us that that's how the journey works. We get our doses of inspiration, but then we have to put in the hard work to bring control back to the conscious mind and to make proper decisions. Just before we finish, those who came late, once again, just to remind you that the new series starts on the 14th of June. I'm away for a few weeks. I'm wishing everyone a Chag Sameach, of course, Shavuot. And if you haven't bought a raffle ticket, now's the time to do it. Thank you. Have a great week.